I don't think I could have done it without my wingman. I mean, he had situational awareness that I didn't. I mean, my airplane was plunging to the ground, totally out of control, and all I could focus on was flying the airplane. It just trying to get that airplane under control. Meanwhile, the enemy is still shooting at us. So he's telling me to put out more chaff and flare. He's telling me to move my airplane over to the west side of the Tigris River where the friendlies were so that if I had to eject, I could at least eject over their location. I mean, I just didn't have the brain bites for this at the time. And so to have him, to have a wingman by your side that when you're feeling overwhelmed, when the adrenaline is pumping, like to have somebody that says, hey, I can step in and help you see the bigger picture. I mean, that's not just a lesson over Baghdad. That is a lesson for life. And so I try to share some of those stories, you know, to engage them through the stories, but also to share the lessons that I learned without them having to experience flying a combat mission over Baghdad.
Welcome to Kick Cage.
Welcome once again to the Kick Cage and the first episode of 2023. We're very honoured on this episode to have Kim Casey Campbell join us, who is a very sought after keynote speaker and a former A-10 pilot in the United States Air Force. Welcome, Kim. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start the podcast in a bit of a strange way because I'm going to put out a question that I'm going to base the whole podcast about. And to you, what is good leadership?
That's a very broad question, but I'll do my best to answer
it. It's intended to be.
I think good leadership is made up of so many things. But I think for me, when I think about good leaders and the leaders that I've worked for, who I have been impressed with and who've just inspired me to be better, I think about leaders that have created an environment of trust, of connection, where you're willing to do just about anything for them because you believe in them. You believe that they have your back, that they're willing to empower you and support you and encourage you. That's kind of the nice side of things, but they're also very demanding in terms of mission and capability and credibility. So I'm not sure if I answered that with just one answer, but I think it's a combination of things, right? You want the people person that's engaging and will connect with you, but you also want somebody that is going to be get after the mission, right? To get after it and do a good job.
Exactly. I wanted to start the interview with a very leading question because I wanted it to be the purpose and the scope of what we're going to talk about. So to put some validity to your advice, to some weight behind it, so I wanted to talk about your military pedigree, so to speak. Most people that I've interviewed have had an experience such as 9/11 that's driven them to join the military. But yours was a space shuttle accident, I'm led to believe.
Yeah, that is very true. I was well on my military path when 9/11 happened. I decided that I wanted to be a fighter pilot, join the Air Force when I was in fifth grade. So I'll date myself here. That was 1986 when the Challenger space shuttle launched. Watching that for me had just such a significant impact. And I don't know. I didn't know why then. I still struggle with trying to understand it, that I watched the space shuttle launch and it obviously did not end well. I mean, we lost all of the astronauts in that launch. It was a terrible accident, but there was something that drew me to it in terms of knowing that these astronauts died doing something that they believed in, that they thought was important, that was bigger than themselves, that they were willing to risk their lives for it. And so there's something that connected me with that. And also this, you know, this thrill of flight. And so I decided then that I was going to be an astronaut. And after talking to my parents, they said, well, a lot of the astronauts are pilots. You might consider that path. And so did a little bit more research and decided, all right, I'm going to go to the Air Force. I'm going to become a fighter pilot. And then ideally would go on to become an astronaut.
So obviously going into, the United States Air Force, you go in as an officer, I believe, if you want to be a pilot. So what was that environment like for you in that era?
When I went to the Air Force Academy, this was 1993. So women had just been authorized to be fighter pilots in the U.S. Air Force. So at least I had that behind me. I was not the first. But even at the Air Force Academy, there were very few women. I think we were sitting at about right about 16% women. And, you know, I got very used to being in an environment where I was the only woman or one of few. But, you know, what I learned very quickly was that if I was credible, you know, I went into the Air Force Academy physically fit, ready to go, and I proved myself very early. And so it didn't matter. I mean, I looked at these guys in my squadron, they were my brothers. They looked out for me and, you know, they supported me. So I had a very positive experience. And I think a lot of it goes down to, or comes down to just credibility, being credible and good at what you do. Yeah. And I mean, the rest doesn't matter.
And I think that, again, is translatable to civilian life, isn't it? When it comes to job roles, when it, having that credibility behind you, it's a massive thing.
Absolutely. I think, you know, when people ask about, you know, how I was successful or how I dealt with this very male-dominated career field, I mean, there are a lot of them out there, not just the military. And I think it does come down to credibility. You know, you got to go in prepared, right? You got to have your shit together before you go in to go do something like that, but go in prepared and then work hard once you're there. And to me, the rest really takes care of itself.
What was it that attracted you to the A-10 as a fixed wing airframe? Because obviously during that time there would have been, you know, a wide variety of airframes that you could have chose. What was it that drew you to that specific airframe?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I don't think the A-10 was like super popular at the time because, I mean, obviously Desert Storm had happened and that was very significant and the A-10 did tremendously, but then it just kind of, you know, wound down again and nobody's really talking about that type of conflict. And so everybody was after these sleek, sexy fighters. Yeah. And I just realized it wasn't for me. I started talking to other pilots and what they did and their missions and what they liked about the airframe. And I realized one that flying the formation stuff was cool. It was exciting, but I really enjoyed the low-level flights. And when I started talking about to other A-10 pilots about their role and what they did in close air support, I was like, well, this is a mission I can get behind. I mean, our whole role is to provide support to the troops on the ground and help these guys get home safely to their families. Like, that was something I could get on board with. So I didn't go in knowing that I wanted to fly the A-10, but towards the end of my time at pilot training, the more research I did, the more people I talked to, I knew that it was the path that I wanted to take, was to fly a close air support airplane. And obviously there's none better than the A-10.
Absolutely. Do you think the its nickname, the Warthog, is justified? Because I don't find it an ugly beast.
Well, you know, it's but nobody calls it the Thunderbolt too. I mean, it's the Warthog. I mean, it's just an affectionate term. I think, you know, it's fitting, right? It's this, we'll get down low and slow and get dirty and just get in the fight. And so I think, you know, the Warthog is a very fitting name.
I found that with F-16 Fighting Eagle pilot that I spoke to, he refused to call it Falcon.
The Fighting Falcon. It
refused to call it Fighting Falcon. It was a Viper.
The Viper. Yeah, they won't call it that either. I don't know. I think it's just I think our nicknames are probably more fitting anyway.
Going on nicknames, well placed there, is obviously Casey being in your initials, but is also part of your call sign.
It is.
Now I always found this fascinating, especially with Top Gun, how all the names must have had some sort of significance, as in Goose, Rooster. Obviously yours, Casey, has some significance. Now I find this quite fascinating because it's the whole squadron that come up with the nicknames. Now, would you feel it would have been the same nickname if it was the leadership choosing it or the whole squadron?
You know, I don't think it would ever be the same if the leadership is choosing names. It's much more exciting and more fun when the whole squadron is involved. But having said that, the leadership is in the room, so they're very much a part of it. And we're not in the room, right? We're not in the room when we get named. And so it's always this, a little bit of dread as you walk back into the room and everybody's cheering and yelling. And keep in mind, this happens in a bar on a Friday night. And so it's a good time, but it's always a little worrisome of what name you're going to get. And for me, I mean, I was the only female in our fighter squadron. So flying the A-10 killer chick seemed very fitting. And certainly one I wasn't going to complain about either. But once I flew with the call sign in combat, which happened very quickly after I arrived at my first fighter squadron, you know, then it's with me for life. So, no complaints over killer chick. And I go by KC. It's shorter, it's easier to say, and everybody just assumes it's my initials anyway.
Exactly. Getting the call sign for any pilot, especially to yourself, how significant is that moment? Is it comparable to a Navy SEAL getting his trident?
I don't know if it's quite comparable to that. I mean, I think when we get our wings the first time, that's a big deal for us as well, our pilot wings. And I feel like it's like every step you get, there's always one more, right? There's always one more thing. Okay, so now I'm a pilot, but now I, you know, I'm just a basic slick wing pilot. And then I get, you know, where I can fly the A-10, and that's pretty awesome. For the A-10, though, it's really all about shooting the gun for the first time. So there's that. And then you finally get to your combat unit, and you have to go through a combat mission qualification. So you've got to get combat mission ready. Yeah. So then there's that. And then finally, you get your call sign. So there's many steps along the way. But it's kind of like, all right, now I'm really a fighter pilot, right? Now I have a call sign. I've shot the gun. And then, of course, you know, the next thing for A-10 pilots at the time for us was like, okay, are we going to go do what we've been trained to do and go to combat? So, you know, it's I guess it's that thing in life. You achieve something and then there's like, okay, what's next? Where do we
Absolutely.
Go?
Obviously, like you just alluded to, the going to combat is obviously the next step. Now, you obviously were in the service when 9/11 happened, and one of the first places you were sent was Afghanistan. Now, from my understanding, my research is Afghanistan for you was not a kinetic environment.
It was not. I mean, we got there. Let's see. I got to my unit early 2002 and we deployed shortly after. And by the time we got there, Operation Anaconda had finished, and it was quiet. I mean, it was eerily quiet. We did a lot of convoy escort, a lot of just being overhead supporting troops on the ground. But it was very, very quiet. I mean, I did a few, I would say kinetic in terms of dropping flares for special forces and night raids, but that was about it. I mean, it was just, it was not what we thought it would be, but probably in a good way. I mean, ideally we're not engaged because that means our troops on the ground are not engaged. But it was a very different environment than we thought we would be going into.
So in that time, obviously we've got war fighters, we've got pilots who aren't being kinetic. You're not in a two-way range. What was the leadership like during that time when you've got all these warfighters that aren't getting what they've signed up for? How did the leadership cope with that?
You know, I'm not sure I remember our leadership specifically saying anything. For me, it all came to like this realization when I was supporting some guys that were going from one of the forward operating bases, the FOBs, to another. And we were sent out ahead of time to kind of look at some points on the road. And after a while, we were just like, oh, you know, it's like, I can't look at these points. They're dirt. It's the ground. There's nothing there. And what are we doing? And then we hear kind of the crackle over the radio. And I remember just hearing one of the soldiers, and he said, look, I'm not a qualified controller. So if something happens, it's what we would call at the time was emergency close air support, because he wasn't qualified to call in strikes. And I could hear the fear in his voice because he was talking about they had gotten intel of an ambush, and I could hear it. And I was just, it was this realization to me, like, well, we've got this, we've got you, we're overhead, like nothing's going to happen. We're going to be here if it does. And it was this realization for me that even though what we were doing wasn't really very exciting, it made the troops on the ground feel better. It gave them courage. It gave them confidence that we would be with them throughout their transition from one FOB to another. And that mattered, right? Like it made a difference. And maybe just by us being overhead, the enemy didn't engage. So that gave me a new perspective on what it meant to be a close air support pilot. It's not always kinetic. It's all just about supporting the troops on the ground and what they need. And I think over time, we all kind of came to that realization.
Yeah.
But it took some time.
During that time, going from training to this new environment from yourself, what leaders stood out for you during your training? And what leaders stood out for you the first time you went in country? And what was the difference in their leadership techniques?
I think, you know, I had a benefit of some incredible squadron commanders and our deputy squadron commanders, if you will, really just tremendous leaders from a perspective of, you know, we had a squadron commander who's also the same person that retired me when I retired from the Air Force. That tells you the kind of person he was, that this was one of my very first commanders and really stayed in touch throughout my career. You know, he cared about us so much, and that was so apparent, but he would also hold us to a very high standard. So we would get, you know, we would get our ass chewed if we didn't have, you know, things done right. But at the same time, like, he would come and put his arm around you and give you a hug and just tell you how much he cared about how awesome we all were and what we were doing. And it was just that dynamic, right? Of like someone super tough, but also very caring about the people on his team. I think, you know, having a commander who believes in you, who trusts you, who will empower you to make decisions, I think that was really apparent to me later on in Iraq. I had a commander that I flew with that, you know, he trusted me as a pilot, believed in me as a pilot, and supported me. I mean, those are things that stick out to me a lot, is just having somebody that really has your back. I think that's probably one of the most important things that I've seen with the commanders that I've worked for. And I'm really looking at the kind of the early days. I feel very lucky to have had such good commanders in the early days of my career, because I think it influenced me, you know, down the road when I became a commander and a leader, as I got to look back and go, that's what I want to be like.
Obviously, you just alluded there that you were in Iraq, and now that was more the kinetic environment for yourself.
Yeah.
And during this time, was this the time that you were married during the time you both deployed in Iraq?
Yes. My husband and I we got married in 1999, but we both deployed at the same time, but not together, not in the same location, to Iraq in 2003. So got home from Afghanistan in 2002, and then very quickly turned to go to Iraq in 2003.
Obviously, just for the benefit of the podcast, Kim's husband as well also flew A-10. So that, what a power couple that would have been, both flying incredible pieces of machinery.
We have some great conversations around the dinner table.
I could imagine. So looking at Iraq, with it being a kinetic environment, let's talk about some challenges and difficulties that you had during that time. At what point did you first start to feel the pressure of the job? Because obviously Afghanistan, like you say, wasn't particularly kinetic. You were dropping flares for night raids for SF. Now you're going to Iraq, completely different game, very kinetic. At what point did you feel that change in yourself?
I think I knew the second we landed in Kuwait. I think we landed and it was like fighter aircraft, rescue helicopters as far as you could see. I mean, it was totally different than when I had been there before for Operation Southern Watch. I mean, it was like we knew we were going to war. And just the threat briefings, the intelligence updates, everything leading up to that, it was different. So much so that our squadron commander had us write letters home to our families if we didn't make it. And I will tell you, that puts things into perspective pretty quickly. Not letters that you want to write, but I wanted to fly, so I wrote the letters. But I mean, it's just, you could tell this was different. We knew there was a lot of buildup. There was a lot of discussion, obviously, but it just felt different. It felt like we were definitely going to war.
So going up on these missions, when you come back, did you have time to decompress and compartmentalize everything that you'd just been through? When you'd been so close to danger, Did you realize at the time you'd been so close to danger? Because I know you had a very near miss.
Yeah.
If you wanted to talk about that and how you felt afterwards. And if you ever allowed yourself time to really come to the realization of how close it was and what happened.
I think, you know, in the early stages, I flew during the day for the first several weeks. And I don't think we knew that we were getting shot at, even though we were, because my first night mission, I was like, what is, it's like fireworks. What is going on? And they're like, yeah, that happens all the time. I mean, and they're just shooting at noise, but still I realized that that was probably happening during the day and we just didn't know about it, which maybe was better. But you know, I had a couple missions where some advice that I got was to write a journal at the end of each day.
Yeah.
I didn't do this very well, but I tried. And I'm so thankful I did, because I have this journal of some really cool stories of what I was thinking at the time. And I would say that that journal helped me decompress at the end of each day. It helped me kind of compartmentalize and tuck some things away. But my mission on April 7th was a little bit different. I mean, getting hit with a missile in an airplane and flying it back home and not knowing whether you're going to live or die is... That took more than a journal. Let's put it that way. You know, I think we do a pretty good job sometimes of just not dealing with it. And I don't know that, and I'm not recommending that course of action, but it worked for me after that mission on that deployment, was to just kind of acknowledge that it happened, but then just tuck it away and know that I was going to have to think about that another time. Because for me, the war was still going on. I had to be able to get back in the airplane. And it was just, I needed to be able to get back and get back in the fight. And for me, it was compartmentalizing it and realizing that I would talk about it later. I would deal with it later, which worked out. It worked out for me. And the fact that, the mission where I got hit was on April 7th. And then on April 8th, I was sitting combat search and rescue alert, which is another one of our primary missions. And we got launched. I mean, an A-10 pilot had been shot down. And so I didn't have time to think about my next mission after that. I just raced to the jet as fast as I could. And, you know, those guys were there for me the day before. I was going to do the same for this pilot. And so I didn't have time to think about getting back in the airplane, which was probably the best thing that I could have done. It just... get back into the fight, get back into the mission. They need us. Do everything you can. So I don't know that that was the best approach, but it worked. It worked for me at the time.
How long afterwards did you allow yourself to think about that? Was it days, weeks after the war itself? At what point did you sort of come to terms with what happened on that day?
I would say months. I didn't really talk about it. I talked about it briefly, but I didn't really talk about how I felt, what I was thinking until I got home and my husband and I were able to take some time off and kind of go through each of our experiences and talk about what we went through. So it was probably months. I mean, I talked about it a little bit. I did write about it in my journal, and you know, it's nice to kind of look back and see what I was thinking. And I talked to my parents a little bit after, because my squadron commander made me call them in the middle of the night. They lived in California, and I woke them up at like 1 a.m. and was like, hey, just so you know, I had a rough day flying the A-10 yesterday, but I'm okay. So you can go back to sleep now. You know, it's just like the most random conversation, and I'm sure terrified my parents. But I did talk to my husband a little bit the following day as well, because he was deployed. He was on the ground working with special forces. And so we got to talk on a secure phone line with like 20 people in the room listening in. So it wasn't all that great of a conversation. But, you know, I talked about a little bit about here and there, but I never really dove into what I thought, what I was thinking, what I was feeling, and quite honestly, how scared I was on that mission.
Yeah. How beneficial has it been to the pair of you both doing the same sort of job at the same time? Were you able to bounce your thoughts and feelings off each other after, you know, difficult missions, difficult days? Did it help both having the same job role?
Yeah, I mean, it helped a lot. It was really, you know, talk about having a wingman by your side, right? He knew exactly what I was going through, which is, why I was pretty thankful he was sleeping during the time of my April 7th mission, because, you know, from the time that my airplane was hit over Baghdad to getting home to Kuwait and landing safely was about an hour. And I can't fathom what he would have been thinking, you know, what he would have to deal with of knowing. I mean, he knew how losing hydraulics in an airplane in the A-10 is very serious. We do have a backup system, but like, it's not something we were ever trained to necessarily fly in for long periods of time or to land in. And so he knew how serious it was. So I think it would have been really hard for him. So though, you know, that's the downside, right? He knows too much. He knows how serious that situation was. And I can't fathom what it would have been like for him to be awake and listening and wondering what was going to happen for that hour. So I guess there is a downside, but the positive is like at the end of a day or going through upgrades or, you know, just going through tough times, like we get what we're going through. So it's been obviously great. We've been married for 20 public math, 23 years. So it's been good.
Yeah. So moving up the chain of command in your career and getting into a leadership role, what did you take from your time on the squadron to that leadership role? Did you take everything you'd learned from the people who were leading you and try and take the best bits that you took from each of them and mold it to yourself? Or were you already heading in a certain direction with your leadership style?
Yeah, I definitely took some of that with me for sure. You know, I think my first leadership, real leadership opportunity to command was about 10 years into my career. And I was a team of 150 military and civilian personnel. And I think there was part of me that thought that I had to be this, like, you know, here I am, this combat proven tough fighter pilot, right? And so there was a bit of this idea that like I needed to be that way as a leader too. And which doesn't actually work, by the way. But I realized very quickly that what my team wanted from me was to just be me, like to just be authentic to who I was. And I learned that lesson because my 3-year-old son during our change of command ceremony decided that instead of sitting in the front row with my husband, like was the plan, like he was supposed to, decided during the ceremony that he was going to come sit up in my lap. And like, he just kept moving slower and slower and just creeping up his way up to the stage and eventually came up and sat in my lap. And I was like terrified of what my team was going to be thinking of me, of like, she's supposed to control and command the squadron and she can't even control her 3-year-old son. But what I realized in that moment was like, my team actually just wanted me to be who I was. And the day after this change of command, so many people were like, that was awesome to see your son come up and get in your lap. And I think it made me human, right?
I was going to say
it made me human. It made me a real person. And this, you know, whatever this tough fighter pilot combat proven exterior was, I mean, there is that side, right? But I'm also human. I'm a mom, I'm a wife, you know, I'm a lot of things. And so I think very quickly I realized that like people connected with that in a way that I didn't think they would. I mean, that was like the highlight of the ceremony. And so I what I've realized over time, and it's taken me a while to get here, is just this idea of connection and trust, and creating connections with your team allows an environment where they will trust you and bring ideas to you and have conversations with you and give you feedback. And that's the kind of environment that you want.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, we're all human. We all make mistakes. What mistakes did you make as a leader that you learned from?
Where do I start? I think back to some mistakes, and I have this one that kind of sticks out in my mind. I had an excellent team that worked with me when I was a group commander. So now I'm responsible for about 1,000 military and civilian personnel. And I had an excellent team that worked with me, a chief master sergeant, who was just incredible and really down to earth, wonderful, wonderful human being, who had my back, who gave me feedback. And I remember one day he came in and He told me something. It was really not important. It was something about, we had some very late reports, and they're performance reports, and it gets tracked and it gets briefed up to the general officer level. And I don't know, maybe it was in a bad mood. Maybe it was just a bad day, whatever. But I kind of responded to him in a way that I probably shouldn't have. Just, you know, it wasn't his fault. He was giving me bad news. It was bad news, right? Yeah. Like, not his fault. Don't shoot the messenger, which is exactly what I did. And, you know, it's just a reminder. I think after that happened, I, of course, apologized, and, you know, it was minor in the scheme of things. Right. But it's this reminder of sometimes when we're in those moments of feeling overwhelmed or stressed or frustrated about whatever it may be in our lives, just take a deep breath for a second. Like, when something happens, like, take a deep breath, don't respond angry, don't type angry, don't text, don't, you know, any of that angry, just take a deep breath and relax for a second, and then take the right action, which for me would have been totally different if I had done that.
I think what you're talking about there is emotional intelligence is one of the things that we get taught. So obviously it's, as you say, not responding in an emotional way, because obviously sometimes you don't get the best response in return.
No, and right, like, I know this, right? I could talk about this all day, but sometimes, like, we're all human, right? And it just happens. And so I think sometimes, though, the most important thing you can do in that moment is just, I made a mistake, I'm sorry, like, I should not have responded that way. And just kind of that honest, open, like, we're all human, we make mistakes. And I think, you know, your team wants to hear that. They want to know that you don't have all the answers, that you do make mistakes, that you will fess up. I mean, that's what you expect of them. Why wouldn't you do the same thing? But sometimes it's just hard. It's hard to do.
Obviously, having that amount of people under your command, having different leadership styles for different people, or did you have that one leadership style for the whole group of people, or did you take it quite personally? Did you have transactional leadership and transformational leadership depending on the person you were dealing with?
It's a good question. I think I probably was, I would hope that I was pretty consistent across the board. I mean, obviously my relationships with people differed based on where they were in the chain of command, but I really tried to, I mean, obviously my first line squadron commanders who, you know, I had to trust and empower to do their jobs, I had a very close relationship with. But I also, when I got out and visited my units, and granted, my units were spread across South America, Central America, and the Caribbean, and so different dynamic, but I really tried to get out and about and talk to, you know, the youngest airman, the youngest person on the team. And just, a lot of times you can find out what's going on in the unit by talking to the youngest and the lower levels of an organization. So I really tried to make sure I made time for them and to walk around and talk to them and find out where they were struggling, what they were frustrated with, where I could help. You know, I would let them teach me things because, you know, as a A-10 pilot, like, my team was civil engineers. They were lawyers and doctors and air traffic controllers. This is not my area of expertise. And so I did my best to just learn from them and let them teach me, which was awesome. I got to drive a front loader. I got to go in a burn house with my firefighters. So I did a lot of really cool things that I was totally uncomfortable doing. But I think, you know, that's part of it too, right? If you're going to create connections and really get to know your team and find out how they are experts in their fields, then go watch it. Go, not just watch it, but get involved in it.
Do you think having that human interaction with, like I was saying, the lower ranks, the people that were doing different jobs to yourself, do you think having that human interaction, taking an active interest in the roles they were doing, actively listening to what they were saying, do you think that aided your leadership with them?
Absolutely. I think, one, I learned a lot personally, you know, as a leader, like what I could do for them, where they were struggling. But I think, again, it's, you know, it makes you human. It creates these connections on a very human level. And I think because of those connections, because of those relationships, it allowed me to get information as well. It allowed me to, you know, allowed people to feel comfortable, like, bringing up new ideas, you know, trying out new things, providing feedback. I felt like it was very beneficial in a lot of ways. You know, for me personally, learning more about my unit, but also creating an environment where people are willing to try new things. They're willing to get outside their comfort zone. They're willing to bring up these maybe a little, I don't know, ideas that are a little bit crazy, innovative, you know, something different, right? Let's stop doing it the way we've always done it if it's not the most effective or efficient way. And so I think it opened up opportunities for that, that at least I was willing to listen, you know, and that, and to take into consideration their thoughts and thinking about things.
Now, leadership isn't always a bed of roses. It's not always, you know, positive as we're painting it. Sometimes we have to have difficult conversations with the people below us. Was that also a learning curve for you in how to approach difficult conversations? Or was that something, again, you might have picked up from previous peers?
Yeah, I don't like the difficult conversations, right? It's not the fun part of leadership, but it is necessary, right? You have to do it. You have to have the difficult conversations and do the hard things. And I would say probably my most challenging time as a leader was having to remove one of my squadron commanders. Probably the hardest thing I've ever done. And, you know, we had some very hard, tough conversations leading up to that. And ultimately I made the decision to remove him from command. And I mean, that was tough. It was tough for me, you know, from a leadership standpoint. I felt like I failed as a leader, right? You feel like you should be able to fix them or help them or mentor them, anything to get them to a point where, you know, they could continue. And I just couldn't get there. I mean, it just was not a good situation. And I felt like the best thing I could do for him and for the unit was to remove him, but it was really hard. It was probably one of the most difficult conversations I've had, because you know that you're impacting someone's life in a way that's not, you know, positive. And on the other side of that, right, I'm doing this for the team. I'm doing this for the unit as a whole. And so making that difficult decision was very hard for me, but it was the right decision. But you're right. It is not easy. No. It is not fun, but it is necessary as a leader to make the tough calls.
Did you find yourself worrying how you'd be perceived by the rest of the unit the first time you had to have a difficult conversation with someone? You know, obviously they had this image of you, you know, as the mother, as a leader that would come down to the lowest job and get involved, you know, not willing to do it yourself and then asking somebody to do it, you were down there proving it with them. So the first time you had to have somebody in your office and give them a bit of a dressing down, was there something in the back of your mind thinking, I'm going to be seen slightly different tomorrow morning?
I don't know. Yes and no. I think I go back to some of the leaders that I talked about in the very beginning. Of the leaders that I respected most were the leaders that were like, you know, be very tough on us, but also show that they cared about us. So I knew that was a part of it. And, you know, it's not fair to everybody else when everybody else is doing a good job if you're not going to hold the people accountable that aren't. Yeah. And so I think there's always that bit of like, this is going to get around. People are going to hear that this happened. But I guess I came to grips with it. You know, we have to be tough. We have to be hard and hold people accountable. We also have to care about people and provide that feedback in a human way. So it's a balance.
Absolutely. Do you feel blessed that you had all these positive influences as you were going through your career and up through the ranks? Do you feel that that has, you know, definitely given your leadership style a kickstart, so to speak? If you'd have had bad leadership as you were coming through, do you reckon you would have not been at the stage you were when you took these leadership roles?
Yes, but I've had some bad leaders too. And I think we actually can learn just as much from bad leaders and kind of recognizing like, I'm not going to do it that way. That did not go over well. Yep. And so I think it's really how you look at it. I mean, having a bad leader is just, it's painful. It's frustrating. And as you know, as best you can to take the time to learn from it and to just recognize that, you know, as you're trying to survive a bad leader, to try to just pull those lessons too. So I think you can learn just as much from a bad leader. I feel very blessed to have had some very excellent leaders very early in my career.
Now, obviously, we've been talking the leadership role as a purely military basis so far. Now, putting some advice out there for people who are going to be transitioning from the military to civilian life and civilian roles. Now, we all know how difficult it can be going from military life to civilian life, especially the corporate world. How would you best advise somebody taking what they've learned in the military through leadership and discipline, management techniques, and, you know, conversing that into civilian corporate life?
You know, I think the best thing I could say is don't sell yourself short. Like, there's so much from the military experience that we've done that sometimes we just look at and go, we're just doing our job, right? This is my job. This is what I do. It's not a big deal. But it is a big deal. And I'm on the board for the Special Operators Transition Foundation, and we help special operators transition out into the corporate world. And the thing that I hear most often is like, they just sell themselves short and they've done so much. And so finding that mentor, somebody that you can talk to that can help translate, you know, what you've done is important, because I think sometimes it's just hard for us to see how it translates on the other side. Yeah. So to find somebody that can help you do that, to just, you know, I had a very senior enlisted person tell me, well, yeah, I made decisions, but there was always an officer over me that, you know, was ultimately responsible. And I'm like, you know what? I don't believe that. Like, yeah, okay, yes, there is an officer over you at some point, but when you're like out in the middle of nowhere, there's nobody there right now, but you, and you are responsible. And so it's just, sometimes we sell ourselves short. And I think finding somebody to help you translate that can really help. There are obviously a lot of organizations out there that are trying to help veterans transition, because it is a hard time. It's hard to transition going from something that you've done for, you know, a long time, for me, for 24 years, and transitioning out and finding out how that relates. But it does. There is so much that we have done in our military background. We know how to lead and manage teams. We know how to handle complex problems. We know how to communicate clearly, concisely, correctly. You know, there's all these things that sometimes seem small, but they are a big deal, and they are important, and they are relevant in the corporate world as well. I'm a little passionate about this. Sorry.
No. This is one of the reasons why I was very pleased to get you on the show and speak about this. What's your thoughts on the difference between the UK and the US when it comes to veterans transitioning to civilian life? I know I've got my views on it. I feel that America seems to do it slightly better. There's a lot more veteran-owned organizations that help veterans transition, people like yourself doing public speaking, whereas the UK, there's a handful, you know, special operators that you could probably say are on mainstream view, whereas the US, that it seems to be an ever-growing culture.
Yeah. I have to say, I don't know as much about the UK in terms of veteran transition programs, but part of the reason we do it well is because we didn't do it well. We failed at this as a nation in taking care of our veterans. So we're trying to get back up there. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot more organizations out there, is because we did not do it well. And it's been costly. So I think we're really trying now. There are more organizations out there that are really trying to help veterans transition, because it is such a hard time where you come from this environment of camaraderie and teamwork and being around people and having a mission and a purpose. And then you transition, and sometimes that's just not there, right? You know, it's that sense of camaraderie is gone. You feel like you have no purpose until you find something where you do have purpose again. And so I think it's just a very hard time. So if we can help our veterans in that transition stage, we set them up for success, not just them, but also their families. We set them up for success in the long term. It's important. I mean, it is the reason I joined the board for the Special Operators Transition Foundation, is just, it is an important part of what we do for people that have given so much.
Do you think that, being a veteran yourself, you understand it more than if it was a government owned, incentive program that was being run? Do you feel that you've got more of a connection and more of an understanding of what they've been through and what they're going through as they're transitioning?
Yes, I think having somebody that's been through it is important, because they know what people are going through. They know kind of the trials and tribulations and the struggles. So I think it is important to have people that have been there, have done it, you know, they don't necessarily have to be in charge of it, but to bring those people in and get their experience and get their feedback of what works and what doesn't, where they need help the most, I think is important.
Looking at some statistics, in 2012, I believe, the US were losing more veterans to suicide than they were the conflict in Afghanistan, which I find, yeah, you know, a terrible statistic. Yeah. I know it's improved thanks to organizations like the one you're working for. So how did you get involved with this organization?
You know, so they actually reached out to me to see if I would be interested in joining the board. And, you know, my whole career has been, you know, my passion and my purpose, right, where my value I felt was supporting our troops on the ground. And when I stopped doing that, it was hard. I mean, I loved flying the A-10. I loved the mission. I loved everything about it. And so when I stopped doing that, there was this like vacuum, like this empty space of like, I miss it. But I have since found a new passion and purpose, right? I spent some time at the Air Force Academy instructing and teaching, you know, our next generation of leaders. And I felt renewed passion and purpose with that. And then when I retired, I kind of decided that I would continue on with that in terms of speaking and writing and putting a book out. And, you know, those were things that were important to me and that I felt passionate in, that I could share stories and lessons that I learned to help other people. And when the Special Operators Transition Foundation, we call them SOTF, that'll be easier for me to say for short, when SOTF reached out and they said, hey, would you be interested in joining the board? I was like, how can I say no to this? I mean, these are the people that I've been supporting for 20 plus years. Yeah. I would love to continue to do that just in a very different way. And so it's been great for me. I think, you know, like I mentioned, I miss the camaraderie. I miss the teamwork. I miss that environment. And I have been able to find that on the outside of the military through these different organizations.
Again, it's still serving the purpose of something bigger than yourself, isn't it? When it comes to being on this board and you're still helping, you know, the boots on the ground, the lads that you were protecting while you were in the air. You also do keynote speaking for dinner engagements and obviously the corporate world. What advice do you find yourself giving these corporate organizations?
You know, I talk a lot about my experience over Iraq on April 7th, because I think that moment was so life-changing for me. You know, I learned so much about myself, but I also learned about teamwork. The fact that I had a wingman on that mission, you know, when my airplane was hit, I don't think I could have done it without my wingman. I mean, he had situational awareness that I didn't. I mean, my airplane was plunging to the ground, totally out of control. And all I could focus on was flying the airplane. It just trying to get that airplane under control. Meanwhile, the enemy's still shooting at us. So he's telling me to put out more chaff and flare. He's telling me to move my airplane over to the west side of the Tigris River where the friendlies were so that if I had to eject, I could at least eject over their location. Yeah. I mean, I just didn't have the brain bites for this at the time. And so to have a wingman by your side, that when you're feeling overwhelmed, when the adrenaline is pumping, like to have somebody that says, hey, I can step in and help you see the bigger picture. I mean, that's not just a lesson over Baghdad. That is a lesson for life. And so I try to share some of those stories, you know, to engage them through the stories, but also to share the lessons that I learned without them having to experience flying a combat mission over Baghdad. But I think there's so many lessons, there's so many stories. I personally feel like my life was different and changed because of the stories that other pilots had shared with me. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like it's a responsibility to do the same, to share those stories and share the lessons. And so that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I do through speaking. That's why I finally decided to write the book. There's a book called Warthog that was written about Desert Storm pilots. And I've read that book so many times and I have learned so many lessons from it. And I thought, you know, here I am preaching about telling stories and sharing lessons. Like, I should probably put it down in a book. And so I finally decided I would do it. The book comes out March 8th. Which is exciting and also terrifying. You know, it feels very vulnerable to put it all out there. But I think it is important to share stories, to share lessons with the whole idea of helping other people.
Well, just to put a bit more pressure on it, I found it on Amazon and it's on pre-order. So there's a little bit more pressure there for you.
No pressure at all, right? I think, you know, I told my husband for a long time, I spent about 3 years writing the book and and really just thinking back through some of those most impactful moments in my life and the most critical lessons I learned. And there were moments where I would tell my husband, like, I'm going to write this book and I'm not going to have the courage to publish it. And he just laughed because, you know, I put so much time and effort into it. But, you know, and the book is about leading with courage and doing the hard things. And so he just occasionally would look at me and be like, you need to take your own advice. So the book is coming out. There's no turning back now.
Obviously, what can people expect from the book? Because obviously there's a lot towards leadership, as you just said. Purely being on that perspective, or like you say, is it going to be a compilation of stories and then describing how it is based on a leadership role?
It is stories. It is stories focused. It's stories from my life and mostly flying stories. The book is titled Flying in the Face of Fear, A Fighter Pilot's Lessons on Leading with Courage. And I'll be honest, I was really not certain about using the word fear in the title, because I think sometimes people get nervous about that word. They think it's like weakness and, you know, it's just vulnerability. It's, you know, tends to have negative connotations, but the whole point is doing things in the face of fear. Like even when you're scared, even when it's, you're nervous or worried about something in your life, you know, it's all about taking action in that moment. And so that's what it's about. It's every chapter is a lesson on leading with courage, whether it's, you know, leading yourself, leading your family, leading a large team, small team. It is lessons in perseverance and overcoming failure and, you know, making mistakes and learning how to learn from them. And talks about the fighter pilot debrief and how we do that to learn from our mistakes. It talks about having a mindset where you can grow and develop from those mistakes. It talks about leading and empowering teams and how to be that good wingman, you know, how to be somebody that people can rely on. So it's, I don't know, it's very vulnerable for me because it's my stories and it's my lessons. And really they're just lessons that, considerations is the way I put it, considerations for leaders, things that you might want to consider, things that people have shared with me, things that I've learned the hard way, you know, through mistakes and failures along the way. But it is very much story based with lessons at the end.
Obviously I've spoken to quite a few veterans, and a number of them obviously use writing as a form of therapy to sort of get events out of their head almost and put it on paper and put it to bed. Now, these stories themselves, do you feel that that has helped you putting it in a book as much as, obviously, you said you had a bit of a diary going on while you were in deployment? This book itself, do you feel that it's put certain aspects of your life to bed, so to speak?
I think you're the first person that's asked me that. And I think the answer is yes. Like, I do think so. I mean, I was, I have it here. This is my journal that I had during OIF. And I hadn't looked at it in a really long time. Like I had kind of put it in a box, put it in the closet and hadn't looked at it in a very long time. So going through all of it again and really, I don't know, reliving it again and looking at the pictures and the stories and kind of bringing myself back in that moment, I went back and found videos and news stories from the event. And it did bring it all back, but it brought back some really good things as well. Like it brought back like these huge boxes of letters that I got from kids that were in my hometown, you know, just things like that. So it was it was reliving it, but I think in a really good way. Like I think, you know, sometimes we can just, I don't know, not forget about the negative. Like, yeah, that was a pretty terrifying moment and I wasn't sure I was going to survive it, but I came out on the other side and, you know, I lived and I survived and I learned so much from it. And the number of people that have supported me and encouraged me along the way, I think that's kind of what I go back to. So the short answer to your question is yes, I do think it helped me in many ways. And it was a pretty enjoyable process actually to go back and relive a lot of those experiences, even though some of them were painful at the time.
What has your husband reckoned to the book? Has he read through like a proof copy? Has he said anything?
I'm only laughing because he read lots of little snippets along the way. And then finally we were like at the final stage of, you know, it's due in 48 hours. And like, this is the final proof. final proof. I don't know when the final one is, but I'm like, you know, do you want to read it from start to finish? Like, you're in here quite a bit. Maybe, maybe you should read it. So he finally did start to finish, but he had read lots of parts and pieces of it along the way.
Now, taking this book, do you feel that this is going to be aimed towards helping people in the corporate environment who are already there? Or do you feel that this equally might help people transitioning from the military to a corporate environment?
I think both. I think it's the target audience, or the audience that I wrote it for, I guess you would say, is, you know, is leaders, whether they're business corporate leaders or military leaders.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter. It's really, you know, it's for new leaders, like emerging leaders that are, you know, just getting out there, but it's also for those more experienced leaders who are just looking for a new perspective, you know, maybe a spark of hearing something a little bit differently. So I think, you know, it really was intended to be for both the corporate and military side. I mean, there's very much, you know, my background is military. That is where my experience lies. But having done some keynote speaking and executive coaching and working with these companies, I realize how much of it will transition to the outside the military as well.
I've found outside of the military, corporate training when it comes to leadership is incredibly complex and almost, you know, theory based. With they're saying, you know, the Kubler-Ross change curve when you're trying to implement something and acceptance of what's happening around you, or when you're looking at somebody's view of the world, everybody's going to have a different view, or Maslow's hierarchy of needs when you're trying to persuade somebody to do something. They're all very, very complex. So I'm hoping that this book is going to sort of break it down into terms that I'm going to understand when it comes to my leadership role in my civilian job.
I hope so.
what's your thoughts on the corporate processes of teaching leadership? Do you reckon somebody in a corporate leadership role could translate that to a military leadership role being taught those techniques?
You know, I think, I'm part of a team right now called Victory Strategies that does leadership work and leadership development. And on our team is not just military. We have corporate world as well. We have Fortune 500 leaders. We have executives. And I have learned so much from them, you know, that definitely translates. And so I think there's so much that we can learn from each other. And I think that's why the more we talk, the more we learn from each other, I think is fantastic. I mean, that having the opportunity to do that now on my team has been tremendous. I wish I had that in the military. I wish we would bring more people in with a different perspective, different knowledge, different upbringing, because I think that all broadens our perspective.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. Just leave it with two very brief questions. What would be the biggest piece of advice you would give somebody who is looking at leaving the military through end of term of service or retirement? What is your biggest piece of advice you would give them?
I think it would be to go find something that you love to do. Go find something that you're passionate about. Go find your new purpose. It's a hard transition in terms of it's new, it's different, but being on the other side it's also exciting. There's this new chapter, but it's all about finding your purpose, finding your passion, find your why, what is important to you, and give yourself some time to do it. Really think about what is most important to you.
And if you could give your younger self one bit of advice that you've learned up to this point in your life, what would it be?
One bit. And maybe I'm going to cheat here. I would say it might last a little bit longer because there's a lot of advice I would give myself. But I think, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. Don't think that it's going to be perfect the first time. Don't think you're always going to get it right the first time, because you will fail. You will make mistakes. You will not succeed the first time. And it's hard. And it's most important how you respond in those moments and what you do in those moments. But it's not always going to go as planned, and you got to be able to adjust. That was a little bit more than one bit, but
I think that sort of all molds into one very good piece of advice that you give yourself. Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been absolutely brilliant speaking to you about leadership in the military and the corporate world and how they both can merge together. And obviously, that's some great advice for people who want to take their leadership role from the military to the corporate world. So thank you very much indeed for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about the book.
I'll let you know. Well, thank you very much for coming on, and I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks.
Thank you.